Hello and welcome to This Must Be Talking Heads, the show where I go track by track, album by album, through the music of Talking Heads and explore their inspiration and impact. I'm Rodney, your host. Thanks for joining me once again. And today we're looking at the next Talking Heads album, which is True Stories. And this is going to be an episode unlike any other because this project is actually not just an album.
Hi, my name's David Byrne, and I made a movie about a bunch of people in Virgil, Texas.
For those of you who don't know, and by now that's surely not too many, but it's true. After his dalliances on the silver screen in Stop Making Sense and working behind the camera on the band's music videos, David made a movie. True Stories is actually a concept movie, one where the concept is, what if David Byrne wrote and directed a movie? You might remember that as a promotional vehicle for Stop Making Sense, David produced a little video where he was interviewing himself, playing himself and the interviewers. And in that video, we got a little preview of the pitch for True Stories.
What are you going to do next?
A project with songs based on true stories from tabloid newspapers. It's like 60 Minutes on acid.
I'll bet!
David collected odd little stories from tabloid newspapers, but as we'll learn, he also borrowed ideas from lots of places. They all got thrown into the pot and it all boiled down into a series of vignettes that are set in the fictional town of Virgil, Texas, all on the eve of their sesquicentennial anniversary.
It was based on a lot of odd human interest stories that I'd read in the Weekly World News, okay, which is kind of one step down from the Inquirer.
And you kind of played this sort of like this guide.
Yes, I was a guy from out of town.
Right.
Who was kind of the guide and was kind of interested in what was going on in this town, that they were going to have this little, they were going to put on a show, the people in the town.
Yeah.
I was interested in talking to them. I was fascinated by them. And to try and fit in, because it was Texas, I wore a Western outfit.
Right.
Of course, nobody else, big hat.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the jackets and everything else. Nobody else wore a Western outfit, but for some reason, being the out of towner, I thought that's what I should do to blend in.
True Stories features notable appearances from the likes of John Goodman and Spalding Gray. It was written by David with help from Stephen Tobolowsky and his playwright girlfriend Beth Henley. More on them later. It was produced by Talking Heads manager Gary Kerfurst, and it was largely financed by David himself, with a little assistance from Warner Brothers to help polish it off and get it across the line. David plays a narrator who appears in voiceover, but also as a real-life character who drives around the town making observations directly to camera. And at the same time, he walks alongside and interacts with all the people who live there. This is where we see our first little schism, because if you haven't seen the movie, you might think True Stories is just another Talking Heads album. In fact, almost all of the songs were written with a specific character's voice in mind and to fit within certain scenes in the film. After True Stories was released, David told Rolling Stone, "When I had to write these songs that fit the characters and situations, it made it easier than it had been for a number of years because the point of view, the energy level, the style was already set out for me." Because David had written these songs for the characters in the movie, he wanted the actors who played those characters to also sing the songs. For the record company, this was a bit of a problem because they wanted a new Talking Heads album that they could sell, and that was going to be hard if their charismatic frontman was MIA. That's why this album is such an oddity. It's a little bit like Talking Heads doing cover versions of songs that David wrote to go into his personal side project. As a result, there's the film True Stories, which also led to a book about the making of the film. Then there's the Talking Heads studio album, as well as a separate solo album accredited to David Byrne called Sounds from True Stories, with the movie versions of the tracks, as well as other incidental music from the film. To complicate things even further, there's a Criterion Collection edition of this film that came out on DVD and Blu-ray, and that led to the full re-release of the soundtrack, including every music track from the movie in the order in which they appear, and with all songs featuring the original actors on vocals, not David. It's worth pointing out that David actually considers that release to be the ultimate collection of music from that movie, which is presented exactly as he intended. So where does all that leave me? It's too bad for David that my job is to look at the Talking Heads version of the album and to represent all of the songs as we find them, but I'll do my best to incorporate all of that context and all the alternate versions as we go through these songs. All right, we've covered the movie in brief and we'll come back to some of the other musical releases, but for now, without further ado, let's dive into the Talking Heads album proper with the distorted album opener and album single, Love for Sale.
One, two, three!
So right off the top, we get a song that's about consumerism. Under the surface of this throwaway pop rock tune is a comment about the music industry itself. It's a bit like a magic trick is being exposed. Watch out for music, TV, and movies. They're selling you a dream and everything is driven by the almighty dollar. From all reports, Love for Sale was David's attempt at writing something like a Stooges song. In previous interviews, Jerry has cited that the Stooges were a huge influence on him and his bandmates in the Modern Lovers, but David has also referenced them as a huge part of his musical and cultural awakening.
To me, this music, Iggy Pop and the Stooges, was emotional, pure id outburst, but it was also very clever and consciously and creatively done.
Love for Sale isn't as rebellious as anything the Stooges put out, but you can hear from this original demo of the song that the driving guitar riff is already there, although compared to the album version, there's probably a few too many hammer-ons, and the riff just sort of hasn't quite grown its teeth yet. The doubled vocals are also a feature of the demo track that stuck around for the album version. And most of the lyrics are in place too, including a curious similarity between the line, "I grew up too fast and forgot my name," which isn't a million miles away from the imagery of "Give me back my name" from the Little Creatures album. One other little note about this song is that it's one of just a few from this album that David actually sings in the movie, as opposed to being written for another character. Within the film, a woman named Miss Rollins stays in bed and watches TV all day. Although the music video exists as a standalone video, it's also integrated into the movie as she flips through a bunch of channels and stops to watch this song for a little while. She even offers commentary about how the band dance like sticks and how David belongs in a straitjacket. This music video was shot a few days after the one for Wild Wild Life, and it was supposed to support the message of the song by satirizing the way bands are packaged and marketing for mass consumption. It features fast cuts of all kinds of brands and products, like Pan Am and Colgate toothpaste. Just like in commercials for candy bars, you can see nuts falling into swirling chocolate. So too do we see the band members dipped into huge vats of chocolate and wrapped up in tinfoil, ready for consumption. You might be thinking, hey, swimming in a vat of chocolate must be some kind of heaven. But I've actually heard from multiple reports that it really sucked. Mostly because instead of actual chocolate, it was a form of brown clay that was extremely cold and tasted like Pepto-Bismol. On the Love for Sale 12-inch single, you actually scored three versions of the song. Ironically, none of them are identical to the album version. There's a sweetened mix called the Special New Version, which has a few additional production bells and whistles. And compared to the album version, it's just a little bit less straight ahead. Then you get the extended mix, which clocks in at over 6 minutes and is more or less exactly what you would expect. And if you don't have time for the lengthy remixes, there's also the Love Dub mix, which is essentially the extended remix, just distilled down to include only the remixy bits. Up next, it's time that we get right with Puzzlin' Evidence. There's a lot to dig into with this track, and most of it actually isn't about the beat or the melody. It's helpful to once again start from that original demo track and go from there. So here's a taste of what the early song was like. Got your Gulf and Western puzzling. Got the MasterCard puzzling. What you wanted puzzling. Lost what you had puzzling. For some reason, that version has more of a bluegrass feeling, and I'm not sure how deliberate this is, but the backing vocals are pretty sort of flat and nasal. David needed a template to work against if he was going to turn this one into the revivalist classic that he needed for his film. And he found exactly what he was looking for in the Staples sister song, Oh La Di Da. I find the lyrics to Puzzle and Evidence to be more puzzle than evidence. On the surface, it could be a commentary on religion standing in as a substitute for our consumerist urges. It name-checks CBS, Time, and Newsweek, and that's a pretty good indication that we're dealing with a conflict between how we engage with the world beyond our everyday experience, either the real world, through news affiliates, or the spiritual realm, through preachers and persons of faith, the latter being a self-confessed influence on the shape of David's songwriting. If the idea of rebelling against mainstream media leaves you feeling a little perplexed, this might go some way to explaining things. And I should admit, my own knowledge of all of this has a lot of gaps, so I'll go slowly here. But this whole thing can be traced back to the Church of the Subgenius, which is a long-running and extremely fictional religion that began in Austin, Texas in the 1970s. A few years ago, a documentary about the Church of the Subgenius laid out the church's origins, philosophies, and motivations. I think this grab from the trailer kind of tells you everything that you need to know.
We tied together every fringe belief you could think of.
It made perfect sense to me.
Repent! Quit your job! Slack off!
We offer eternal salvation or triple your money back.
The Subgenius was a club. It was a badge.
You may think it's funny. We hope you do. We are trying to deliver medicine of a sort.
Y'all are out to put down outrageous cult groups. What does this mean?
No, this is an outrageous cult group.
As best I can make out, the Church of the Subgenius was a reaction to major organized religion in the US, as well as what you might call the New Age movement. Notable artistic types that have been involved with the church over the years include Penn Jillette, Nick Offerman, Mark Mothersbaugh and Gerard Casale from Devo, as well as, at least at one time, David Byrne. One of the deities that the Subgenius holds up with intense reverence is a fictional figurehead called J.R. Bob Dobbs, often referred to as just Bob. According to Subgenius lore, one of the longest-standing members of the church was actually responsible for assassinating Bob in 1984, and that member's name was Puzzling Evidence. Sometimes abbreviated to Puzz Ev, he is known as the longest-running radio host among the senior figures of the Subgenius, and if this clip from one of their recent broadcasts is to be believed, he was not only the inspiration for the song and the revivalist scene in the movie, but he was supposed to be the star attraction.
David Byrne did take an interest in us, but got distracted with other things.
Indeed, in his movie True Stories, there was supposed to be a scene with a Subgenius revival, which nervous Hollywood executives had to change to a standard religious revival. And yet, for those who pay attention to certain details, it's clear what the actual thing was, the improvisation, the inspiration.
Everything changed when the Hollywood money came from the Ed Pressman Corporation. Up until then, when it was just an underground movie, it was God was going to do the media barrage, and David Meyer was going to be the preacher, and Puzzling Evidence was going to be the Puzzling Evidence.
And that's why Byrne came out with that song, Puzzling Evidence. We didn't get it from him. It was about our guy known as Puzzling Evidence.
By the sounds of it, the Subgenius folks don't hold any grudges, at least not against David, but it also sounds like it's not really something that they want to get into all that much. Whatever the origin story, the band worked up David's basic demo into a big as houses song. In the film, John Ingalls plays the Puzzling Evidence-esque preacher and sings the song in front of a willing congregation, the lengthy intro giving him plenty of time to build up a conspiracy-tinged rant about consumerism, the government, you name it. Ingalls has the right look, but his voice doesn't exactly bring the power and glory, no matter what the lyrics want you to believe. Luckily, the Burt Cross Choir are on hand to elevate things. In fact, in my humble opinion, they absolutely steal the show.
Puzzling,
Okay, we're really hitting our stride now, so let's keep grooving through the album with the next track, Hey Now. This song, along with People Like Us, are probably the two songs on the album with the greatest disparity between the version that David sung on and the version featuring the characters of the movie. First, we'll have a listen to the early demo. Given that Hey Now has all the hallmarks of a mall song, and there's numerous scenes set in malls littered throughout True Stories, it's kind of strange that the kids who are singing this tune in the movie are actually dressed like orphans and are just kind of walking down the street banging on hubcaps. It turns the song into a kind of lament, except that the thing that they actually want most is just right down the street. It's kind of odd, but it's a sweet song, and although I'm a big David Byrne fanboy for life, I have to admit that the version with the children singing is genuinely much better. Those incredibly charming kids belong to the St. Thomas Aquinas Elementary School Choir, and you can hear how the song was really meant to be sung in their voice. There's also a Milwaukee mix of this song that actually features on the Radiohead 12-inch single, and if you listened to the previous episode about Jerry's solo career, then you know all too well the conditions that he and David Vartanian were working under when they produced this alternate cut of the song. From roaming the neighborhood to traversing the astral realms, let's introduce ourselves to Papa Legba. The homemade demo for Papa Legba is a little more crooning than the album version. It sounds a little bit like a chilled out version of the singer from Swamp or something. Paulinho da Costa is peppered throughout this album, but his additional percussion really shines on this track in particular, creating a new sonic landscape previously untapped by Talking Heads. As Chris France described it, he was brought in to bring a little bit of magic to the song. In the pre-chorus, David sings, "Rompiendo la monotonia del tiempo." That translates roughly to breaking the monotony of time, and it effectively implores Papa Legba to grant them safe passage to the other side. That's a journey that sort of doubles as a metaphor for the John Goodman character's search for love. Music historian and author Robert Palmer, and no, not that Robert Palmer, mentions the long and colourful history of Papa Legba throughout the history of American Southern blues music, sometimes explicitly by name or indirectly by reference to the devil. Either way, claims Palmer, all of those songs are actually referencing Papa Legba. A year before True Stories came out, a voodoo-centric episode of Miami Vice actually focused on a Papa Legba-type character. And in the same year that True Stories was released, Another movie called Crossroads came out, which featured a fictionalized encounter at the Mississippi Crossroads between blues musician Robert Johnson and Willie Brown, and the results were that they sold their soul to a Mr. Legba with the promise of successful musical careers. Other pop culture appearances for Papa Legba include the writing of Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett in the voodoo influence on video games like the Monkey Island Adventure series, and he's even been invoked in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Not a bad list of credits. Whether the myth of Papa Legba really fits into the True Stories universe, I'm actually not convinced. But still, we get to hear Pop Staples put his stamp on yet another song that was truly meant to be sung by another person. At first, Pops is kind of meandering through the song, but by the end, he works up a head of steam and gives the song a little bit of a lift.
Now I'm gonna call. Gonna call on Legba. Get yourself a sign. Get your love and desire.
Just between you and me. Sometimes when I put this album on, it's not really until Papa Legba comes on that I'm actually really kind of grooving. So, I reckon this one really jams, and I reckon it's a strong finish to side one, but up next is the big show. So, let's flip over to side two and get into our hero track for this album, Wild Wild Life. One afternoon in 1978, inspiration struck three musicians named Trevor Horn, Jeff Downes, and Bruce Woolley. Legend has it that only 1 hour later they'd written a song that went on to become a worldwide pop phenomenon. You might know the more popular version. Here's another version of the song, which is actually performed by Bruce Woolley and The Camera Club, featuring Thomas Dolby on keyboards. Video Killed the Radio Star is better known as the star vehicle for one-hit wonders The Buggles. They were a band primarily made up of the other two songwriters, Trevor Horn and Jeff Downes. Compared to the Bruce Woolley version, you can hear how their extra razzle-dazzle heightens the song and raises the level of the tune such that we all now consider this the definitive version. Interesting that the lyrics start with, I heard you on my wireless back in 52. That happens to be the same year that David Byrne was born in Dumbarton, Scotland. A number of times, David has reflected about his youth and how, in particular, hearing songs through a transistor radio as a boy opened up his mind to the idea that there was a big world out there beyond his family and his neighborhood.
I had a transistor radio, terrible sound, but you could listen to it in your bedroom, either put it under your pillow so the parents couldn't hear it. The sound, it was like nothing else I'd heard, and that and other things that I was hearing kind of tells you as a kid in the suburbs that there's another world out there. There's things being made that are made for us, whoever us is, and I have to go and find them.
Video Killed the Radio Star is commonly interpreted as a sympathetic tribute to pop singers who might have had the kind of voice that could make it on radio, but lacked the good looks or charisma to be successful on TV, where music videos were growing in popularity. One of the songwriters, Trevor Horn, said this. It came from the idea that technology was on the verge of changing everything. Video recorders had just come along, which changed people's lives. We'd seen people starting to make videos as well, and we were excited by that. It felt like radio was a thing of the past, and video was the future. There was a shift coming. He was right. A monumental change was coming.
6, 5, 4. We've gone for main engine start. We have main engine start.
Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll.
At 12:01 a.m. on August 1st, 1981, a little over 40 years ago, MTV launched out of New York. Overnight, the dynamic of listening to music had changed. Radio was fine if you were in your car or blasting tunes from a boombox, but if you're at home, you could take it to the next level and bring the party right to your television. And what do you suppose was the first music video ever played on MTV? You guessed it. Video Killed the Radio Star. In the first 24 hours on air, MTV played hundreds of videos. You can see the list online, including a counter against each song. Unbelievably, the Phil Collins hit In the Air Tonight featured 5 times. Even this iconic tune was played, achieving the honor of being among the first 100 music videos played on the channel. As you can probably imagine, music videos weren't exactly in abundance in the early 80s. So if you had content that they could play, and people liked it, there was a great chance of being heavily promoted. Throughout the 80s, Talking Heads enjoyed a healthy amount of airplay on MTV, especially for their biggest hits like Burning Down the House, And She Was, and Road to Nowhere. It must have felt like viewers were gorging themselves on everything they put out. With so much attention up for grabs, it's not hard to see why David got to thinking that this insatiable content machine could be leveraged to promote his film. All he needed was a song and a music video that was tailor-made for the MTV audience. The rest would take care of itself. With Wild Wild Life, David set his sights on a big MTV hit. The single was released a month before the movie True Stories came out in theatres, and the song was intended as a kind of curtain raiser for the feature presentation. We can reverse engineer a few things about the song from the early demo version. Again, we go back to David's sessions at home with his guitar and a drum machine where he wrote the songs for the album. This time you can hear a lot of the form is there. Some of the lyrics, though, are still settling into place.
I'm wearing pajamas. I ride a volcano.
One thing that you might have noticed yourself, or once someone points it out to you, you can't help but notice, but other than repeating Wild Wild Life, none of the rest of the lyrics rhyme. All the words are yet again another collection of non sequiturs. And in a strange way, by not rhyming, the song just puts it all out there for you to figure out yourself. And in a way, that makes it even more infectious. Although I think Wild Wild Life is the standout track from the album, for the most part, this is just another simple, straightforward song, no flashy production tricks, no polyrhythms, barely even an undercurrent of deeper meaning, or at least no more than it needs. And that's all because it was written for the movie. The sparsity is entirely by design. Despite on the surface being non-threatening, you can probably read this as another reference to cocaine. Yes, Byrne is, again, taking the everyday and projecting a layer of absurdist outsiderness upon them. But all the subjects that he's chosen, like a businessman or a doctor, are high-earning professions with a proclivity, especially during the powdery 80s, to ride the rails. Despite the obvious references to some kind of heightened state of being, the song is deliberately non-committal about its subject matter. And again, that is in service of the song, and in particular, the music video, which is inextricably linked to the movie. Which brings us to the lip-sync scene. So in the movie True Stories, David's narrator character and John Goodman's Lewis visit a club where various people lip-sync to this song. It's often mistaken as a karaoke scene, but the characters themselves aren't singing the song. They're just miming and kind of dancing. There is a band on stage, but it's not clear whether they're really playing the music or if they're just miming within the reality of the scene. At the rear of the stage is a wall of TVs, and the performances are intercut with reaction shots of the audience. Most of the lip syncers only tackle 2 or 3 lines from the song, which means we rotate through a whole gallery of quirky characters. Not all of them, but a lot of them are dressed in a way that accentuates their character and adds a sense of occasion and an embrace of this shared performative experience. Of this scene, David wrote, "The song itself becomes a vehicle that can say anything that they want it to. Some gestures and movements are obviously derived from well-known sources, TV shows, movies, and most recently rock videos. Odd to think that some lip syncers are imitating characters in videos, and those people are really musicians themselves that are imitating other characters." Of course, by musicians imitating other characters, he's talking about his fellow bandmates. One of the differences between the movie version and the band's music video is the amount of time that Chris, Tina, Jerry, and even David get. For the music video, they each make multiple appearances, something that's toned down for the film. To be honest, I think the music video is by far the superior version. The band members were given carte blanche to pick whatever outfits they liked, and they ran with it. Starting with Chris, he appears as a hair metal frontman, counterbalanced by a Hank Williams-esque country singer, and finally, a sports fan with a Wild Wild Life cap. David himself swoops into frame as a Latino-flavored singer with a loud shirt and thin mustache, and then again as a sweaty version of, I guess, himself. Tina makes numerous appearances, making a splash as a classy sophisticate, an unhinged woman with glasses and big hair, which is revealed to be a wig, and playing Apollonia to Jerry's Prince in an allusion to the musical film Purple Rain. Speaking of Jerry, I think he steals the show, not only for his sultry performance as Prince, but also as a martial artist, a pimp complete with zoot suit, and an absolute star turn as an 80s-era Billy Idol. As a little treat, here's an old clip that I found of Jerry talking about the filming of this video.
Wild Wild Life is a video. The one thing is that it's not the concept so much of the video, but the performance of the video that makes it so able to be watched over and over again. Tina actually suggested the sequence. It was supposedly Apollonia. She played Apollonia and I played Prince, which I think is perhaps the funniest part of the video. But there's so many. I think Chris playing this kind of heavy metal drummer where he butts the camera is great. I like my Billy Idol. I haven't ever met Prince, and I keep wondering what his reaction to this was. I don't think he seems like someone who would like to be imitated.
Also notable in the movie and the music video is screaming stand-up comedian Sam Kinison, who was big at the time. And no matter what you read on the internet, there is no uncredited appearance by Steve Buscemi. All that said, and given the togetherness and celebratory nature of the song, it's crazy that this isn't near the climax of the movie. Instead, it comes in Act 1, and it leaves the rest of the movie to fend for itself, trying to recapture the same level of energy and charm. With all the music and pop culture references in this clip, it's no surprise that the video won 2 MTV Music Awards for Best Group Video and Best Video from a Movie. And the single went on to reach number 25 in the US charts, the last of the band's big hits. If, back in the day, you were one of the ones who threw down your hard-earned bucks and bought a copy of the single, you also scored an extended version of the song that clocks in at an additional 2 minutes as a B-side. Credited to Eric Thorngren, with editing by Chris France, Jack Skinner, and Jerry Harrison, the extended remix of Wild Wild Life has a little extra time on its side, and you can hear certain elements have been teased out a little bit more, my favourite being this little ballgame-esque keyboard part. Despite its high profile in the Talking Heads catalogue of hits, it's rarely been performed over the years during David's solo performances. In fact, it's probably only second to Lady Don't Mind for a song that's very well known that he very rarely performs. However, during his accomplished world tour with collaborator Annie Parsons, aka St. Vincent, he dusted off Wild Wild Life and gave his setlist this joyous boost. It's time to hear the voice of the people as we plumb the depths of the YouTube comment sections, looking for some hot takes about this song. These are comments made about Wild Wild Life on YouTube. Here we go. If you were an 80s kid, you saw this on MTV in 1986. In 2019, I still ride a hot potato. It appears Talking Heads is one of those bands whose songs I regularly heard during my childhood and teens on the radio, and only now have discovered who they were. What is the meaning of this song? It seems like gibberish almost, but I feel like there's a lot of hidden meaning. Never noticed before, but I'm older now. My head just exploded with awesomeness. Was that John Goodman? I'm still not sure if I'm supposed to aspire to the wild, wildlife or not. The one song that makes me dance the ultimate embarrassing dad dance ever. I'm doing it now. Cringe. I adore this song. Viva La Talking Heads. This is the best video that Prince has ever appeared in. To finish off my look at Wild Wild Life, and I'd completely forgotten about this, but the YouTube comments were a handy reminder. Some of you might have heard a cover of this song from the movie Cool Runnings. The infectious interpretation by Wailing Souls proving once and for all that at heart, some songs are just longing for a reggae cover. Up next is a tune that's a bit of a sleeper, but a lot unravels from it. And your first clue's right there in the title. Here's Radiohead. Before I get into this song, I guess the elephant in the room needs to be addressed. Yes, it's true that this song inspired the name for that band. But I'm a creep. I'm a Originally known by the name On a Friday, in 1992, Thom Yorke and his bandmates signed a 6-album deal with EMI on the strength of their live performances and a little demo that they had scratched together. The only catch? They needed a new name. Turning to one of the biggest influences, for some unexplained reason, the name of this tune just stuck. I'm not the only one who scratches his head at that decision. Here's David's induction speech for Radiohead at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I was surprised and very flattered when Radio stated that they had named themselves after a song that I'd written. But I had to ask myself, why that song? I still haven't been able to figure it out. And in a certain way, I don't want to know. This was a kind of goofy Tex-Mex song that I'd written. Maybe we'll find out. Who knows?
Okay, so now we can look at the song itself. As always, I like to hear the origins before we dive deep, so let's hear the original demo. I, for one, did not know that David could sing that high. Radiohead is about someone who claims that they can read a person's tone. I guess you could say that it's a bit like reading an aura. I imagine it's a little bit like looking at someone and kind of tuning into their vibe and just hearing a joyous song in your head. It's actually not that far away from something like This Must Be the Place with lines like, "You've got light in your eyes," or "Sing into my mouth." And as if that Radiohead thing wasn't enough, here's another fun fact for you. Which Hollywood actor inspired the story behind the song Radiohead? If you guessed Stephen Tobolowsky, then bing, you're 100% right. Even earlier than the demo, actor and writer Tobolowsky was making an impact on David's wacky screenplay.
I was in college, and
we were at a movement retreat, and we were going around the circle, and our teacher was saying, say the first thing comes into your head, and the first guy goes Hobbit, the next guy goes Far Out, next guy goes Weed, next guy goes Hobbit, next guy goes Hobbit.
I'm glad to know things haven't changed at all. Those are still the same things you would hear now.
And he comes to me, and I said, I get that you're not who you say you are. Your name is really MK or ML. And then that goes around the circle, Hobbit, Far Out, Frodo, beer, and it goes back around. So we disperse. Then we're headed out for our cars, and my teacher kind of corners me. He said, why did you say what you said? I said, well, I don't know. You said, just say the first thing came into your head. That's the first thing came in. He says, because it was right. I do have an assumed name, and my initials are MK.
Oh.
And I went, oh. So while that 19 Furious Days that we were working on, True Stories, Beth says, tell David, because David wants to put all these true stories in his movie, Stephen, tell him the true story about you hearing tones. And I said, no, baby, no, I don't want, no, tell him the story about you hearing tones. So I sat and told David the story of me hearing tones. And he looks, says, you're kidding. And I said, no, David, that's really the story, but I don't do it anymore. I don't like to do it anymore. It was too creepy, and I don't like to do it anymore. So sure enough, a year later, David has written into True Stories a character that hears tones, and he says, here is a song I wrote for you, Stephen. And we put it in the thing, and it was Radiohead. I'm picking up something good.
So if you ever wondered about the perspective of the person singing Baby Your Mind is a Radio, I hope that helps. There's a variety of Hispanic musical styles on display in Radiohead, from Tejano to Mariachi to especially Conjunto, which is renowned for featuring the sweet mix of 12-string guitars and piano accordion. Accordion extraordinaire Steve Jordan contributes to Radiohead, while Paulinho da Costa again returns to sprinkle a little more percussive magic on this song. And what authentic Conjunto song is not complete without vocals from an expat Scotsman who spent time in New York? You can add this song to the collection of tunes that were written for performers with more authentic Tex-Mex credentials than David. That's why in the latter part of the film True Stories, we transition from pop staples singing Papa Legba right across town to the outskirts of Virgil, where the big celebration of specialness is in full flight. On stage, singer Tito Lavara and his band Los Vampiros are belting out this tune. Tito's character can also be seen in the film's opening, where he's sort of serenading a co-worker with this song, but it's in the closing scenes that he really shines.
So look at my fingers vibrating from the tip down to my toe. Now I'm receiving your signal. We're gonna leave the land unknown.
Tito's version was found on the companion album to the film and, of course, on the Omni release from a few years ago. Tito Lavara was the frontman for an LA Mexican punk band called The Plugs, and they released a couple of albums in the late 70s and early 80s, but they went on to play as Bob Dylan's backing band, of all things, and then they even provided the music for the cult 80s film Repo Man. And among his many career achievements, Tito, along with his wife and daughter, continue to make music and work in the film industry to this very day. So there's already many, many different versions of this song. Why not add one more? In the extended mix, if you listen very carefully, you can spot a little callback to another Talking Heads hit.
Vas a ver, mamacita.
All right, I think we've outstayed our welcome in Radiohead land, so it must be time to mosey on to the next track, which is Dream Operator.
Little, you dreamed you were big. You must have been something, a real tiny kid. You wish you were me. I wish I was you. Don't you wake up, this dream will come true.
This song opens with a nice twinkling little piano, a 1-2-3 waltzing drum beat, and noodly conversational guitar lines before launching into the saccharine lyrics. Musically, this song is pretty repetitive and kind of one note. The only real rise and fall comes through the vocals, which vary depending on which version you're listening to. In the album version, there's a moment where David goes completely off the rails and his voice goes absolutely derpy. It's wild that this made it onto the final mix. And personally, it really sours the song because it feels too much like a temp vocal track on a song that's already a bit of a throwaway. In the movie version of this song, we have a gender reversal, and Annie McEnroe provides the vocals while in character as the announcer at the fashion show. To set the scene a little, David's narrator character and Lewis, who is John Goodman, are walking through a mall and they happen upon a huge stage with a long runway. For the next few minutes, they stand and watch as people parade down the catwalk in fashions that range from mundane to curious to satirical. Depending on your point of view, you could interpret the fashion show as a collection of statements that aren't really quite sure what they're saying as a whole, almost like a bunch of visual non sequiturs. It's as if David's lyrics have somehow anthropomorphized and jumped off his notepad and onto the stage.
The fashion show in the shopping mall has been compared to the ecclesiastical fashion show in the Fellini movie, Roma, I think it is. Whereas the Fellini take might have been more kind of satirical, this was kind of more gentle and taking kind of aspects of American thought and imagination and just pushing it to an extreme and kind of going, what if there were fewer bounds on people's imagination and the kind of vernacular creativity that exists all over the country, and they just kind of went for it and imagine what that could be.
If this all sounds a little out of place in terms of what you imagine David Byrne's worldview to be like, it might help to understand that the fashion scene was, perhaps, a little bit of a sweetheart arrangement with his costume designer and then-girlfriend, Adele Lutz. It seems Adele was a huge influence on the production, and we have her to thank for most of the fashion brackets, like the raincoats, the bridal gowns, and the children in 80s nightclub fashions.
We talked about that it should be a show that the town could do. It would be silly and some parts preposterous, but not impossible that these people would make it themselves.
One noteworthy outfit from the fashion show is a suit made of grass. It's introduced right alongside other suits that are made to look like bricks or various other forms of urban camouflage. The grass suit was actually custom made by a real designer who was thrilled to work with David on the movie. And having made a name for himself as the suit man, it's no surprise that David was drawn to that outfit in particular.
So there was an AstroTurf grass suit, and then it was also one that had real grass in it, which he had to start growing a couple of weeks before that scene was shot, so that when that day came, it was nicely green and sprouted. I tried it on. It was an odd experience. You could, on the inside of the jacket, the roots were coming through, which made you feel in a creepy way like you were underground.
And for one last strange twist on this song, and no, it's not yet another extended remix, there is an instrumental reprise of this song that appears on the movie's full soundtrack. That one's titled Glass Operator. It's a variation that evokes the kind of lo-fi sideshow spectacle of someone playing notes by rubbing the rims of crystal glasses. We might let Dream Operator pull a shape, turn and walk back off the stage as we move on to our next track, something a little more upbeat. This is People Like Us.
In 1950, when I was born, Papa couldn't afford as much. They sent me proud of what you
On People Like Us, David goes full country, and we'll get into the pros and cons of that approach in just a minute. But first, we've got another demo to digest. So again, let's hear David's solo demo for the song, and be warned, the bass on this would rival any club tune from today. So the song is pretty much right there on the demo, and whether David is drawing from his personal experience or not, there's a few echoes from his early life there. Firstly, the opening line, "In 1950, when I was born," is pretty close to his actual birth year of 1952. I imagine the number was only changed just to help it fit the meter of the song. Secondly, I was struck by how this is yet another example of David writing a song that's actually kind of the polar opposite from an earlier song of his. In particular, this one from their sophomore album came to mind. From predicting a future without love, we now arrive at this song where the protagonist assures us that he, and presumably the folks in the town, don't want freedom, don't want justice, they just want someone to love. About that idea, David once said this: "I think it works in the song, but it would be difficult for most people to admit that they'd prefer a comfortable sofa or an evening watching television than freedom of the press or whatever." Another confession from David about this song was that he felt that the movie version, performed by John Goodman, was truly superior to his own. Goodman finds an authentic country delivery that's perhaps helped by even parts naivety and the carefree abandon that only a trained actor can access. People like us, who will answer the telephone. Whether John Goodman understood on any deep level what David was trying to do with True Stories is a bit unclear. In one interview, he confessed that David was working from a different dictionary, but he brings some much-needed energy and pathos to the film. Like Hey Now, I'd argue that John Goodman's version of People Like Us is the superior version of the song, but that's not to say that it's the best version, because for that, we have some very clever person on the internet to thank. They realized that you could lay David's version over the top of the John Goodman version, and then you could sit back and hear them singing in a sweet duet. People like us, who will answer the telephone? People like us, growing big in the house. To tell you the truth, I honestly think that True Stories would have been a better movie if it had focused more on the John Goodman character and let the rest of the unusual stuff recede into the background a bit more. By not drawing so much attention to all the random craziness, it would have been more curious and even less overdetermined. But I'll tell you one thing that I do love, which is the pedal steel guitar playing on this song, and that's courtesy of Tommy Morell. His skill and class really shines on this song, but also the next one, which is the final track from True Stories. So let's move on to City of Dreams. Here where you are standing, dinosaurs did the dance. The Indians told the story, how it has come to pass. By his own admission, David was trying to write a song in the style of Neil Young. It's as haunting as it is dry. It's a bit like looking at your reflection in a dusty old mirror in an antique shop. And now for the last time, let's dig into the bag of demos to hear what the early sketch for this one sounded like. We live in the city of dreams. We drive on this highway of fire. Someone who is really much smarter than me realized that as this song plays over the closing credits of True Stories, it makes a neat little bookend to the film. It's a little bit like the history lesson which plays at the start. And if you haven't seen it, here's a little clip from the opening montage.
A group of Spanish settlers offered the Indians a chance to become slaves. The Indians thought about it, decided it was not a good idea, and killed the Spaniards. The Spaniards were fighting the Mexicans. The Mexicans fought the Americans. The Americans were fighting the Wichitas. The Wichitas were fighting the Tankawas. The Tankawas fought the Comanches. The Comanches fought everyone. Meanwhile, most of the people who now lived here spoke Spanish. Covert military operations to seize Texas for the U.S. of A. were begun in 1835. Eventually, they did get Texas. Land grabbers, railroad companies moved in. The economy boomed. Some people got rich. First on cotton, then cattle, then oil, and now microelectronics.
As the album and the movie wind down, we have this final reminder that modern cities and towns are built upon land that belongs to the native people. The imagery of a city of dreams is a non-judgmental way of evoking their lingering presence, while riding on a highway of fire is a textbook Burnism. There's an instrumental reprise of this track, which is called City of Steel, that appears on some of the other soundtrack releases, and maybe I've just heard this song too many times, but for me, it's just as impactful as the vocal version. It's as if the music has somehow absorbed all of the poignancy and the words kind of just aren't needed anymore. Let's talk for a minute about the other soundtrack releases, because as companions to the film, they feature all kinds of other incidental music, like the Muzak that plays in the mall, love themes, road music, and other supporting tunes. I actually really like this track that's called I Love Metal Buildings. Having written Little Creatures, True Stories, and all the incidental music for the movie back-to-back, it's not surprising that there wasn't a lot of leftover material kicking around for this album when it was reissued. Even the definitive remasters include, like, the album tracks supplemented by the remixes, so if you want bonus material, you pretty much have to dive into the soundtrack albums. But within the bounds of looking at this as a Talking Heads release, the trail ends here. As a Talking Heads album, True Story is charted okay, reaching 17 in the US Billboard charts and doing a little better in the UK by sneaking into the top 10. But the film was not necessarily a popular success. Hopes that it might find an audience or even grow one the way that Stop Making Sense did never actually eventuated. True Stories is, rightly, considered an odd little art house movie. But nevertheless, it developed something of a cult following, and as a piece of creative output, it helped elevate David's standing in the public eye. In fact, the attention on David was so great that he was labelled Rock's Renaissance Man by Time magazine in their October 1986 edition. Not only did they put David on the cover, but they let him design it himself, a rare privilege that only he and former collaborator Robert Rauschenberg had done at the time.
It's kind of one of those things where you're talking on the phone and somebody says it and you go, well, excuse me a minute. And you just kind of walk around the room like, and then you kind of tell somebody and nobody believes it. And it just seems preposterous. It's kind of a shock. I'm glad that I'm kind of going away. I can hibernate for a while and then I kind of don't have to deal with it. Maybe when I get back, I'll be able to go shopping at the supermarket again.
So where did all this attention leave the rest of the band? In effect, they had traded their momentum as a big touring act for a couple of MTV pop hits. However, Talking Heads were at risk of becoming another one of David Byrne's side projects. And that was something that didn't really help the growing tensions between himself and the others.
I think maybe I had done maybe a little bit too much publicity for True Stories. And some of it was too much too quickly. And I think the band felt maybe a little bit of jealousy and a little bit that I was trying to get too much attention to myself. And a little bit, they were a little bit right. It's not always easy. If I do a film, I have to try and get it, people to know about it, get it in the theaters and
get it into a good theater and whatever, and that takes a lot of time, and I have to push for it. So if we're careful, we can keep a balance.
With True Stories finding only a modest audience and David taking a little time off, exactly how to rebalance things with the band was on his mind. If this whole thing was ever going to work again, there was only really one option, a make good. It was time for Talking Heads to regroup, to write music that was the purest expression of their unique talents. A return to the old ways of songwriting, jamming, improvising, feeding off each other. In short, a rebirth. On the next episode, I'm covering the band's last studio album, their eighth and final long player, Naked. And to give you a taste of what's still to come this season on This Must Be Talking Heads, after I cover that album, I'll be featuring part two of my look at the creative output of Chris and Tina with TomTom Club. And in the final episode of the season, I'll be tying up all the loose ends by highlighting special tracks, demos, and live cuts, some of which have never been released officially by the band, ever. All that and more as I close the book on Talking Heads for good. These last three episodes are going to be quite the ride. Before all that, I need to bring this episode to a close, and usually I do that with a cover version of a song from the album, and this time is no different, with one small exception. Normally I try to avoid using the hero track as the closing song, but this one is really too good not to use. So here, with their 2012 cover of Wild Wild Life, is Florence and the Machine.
I'm wearing purple pajamas. I ride a hot potato, tickling my fancy. Well, speak up, I can't hear you.
Channeling the spirit of Wild Wild Life as a promotional juggernaut, Florence and the Machine released this cover to coincide with the announcement that they were headlining the UK's four-day music extravaganza, Best of All Festival. In their own clip, the band not only dress in fur pajamas, but as various animals and woodland creatures, thus putting their own unique spin on living a wild, wild life. Thanks for listening to another episode of This Must Be Talking Heads. Once again, I've been Rodney, your humble host. And if you want to ask me anything or give me any feedback on the podcast, you can send me an email directly at talkingheadspod@gmail.com or by sending a message through my website, which is thismustbetalkingheads.com. On the website, you can also find all the previous episodes, as well as links to all of the books and interview clips that I used to pull this whole thing together. If you appreciate the show and want to pledge your support, there's a link to my Patreon on the website where you can throw in as little as a couple of bucks a month to help cover my running costs. In exchange, you'll get access to my unedited interviews with Chris France and Jerry Harrison and more, as well as dozens of audio diaries that I've been keeping about making this whole project. Lastly, with all of that said, I hope you've been enjoying what you've been hearing and that you'll come back next time after busting out your CDs, dusting off your vinyl, or tuning into your favourite streaming service, because next time we're diving deep into the final Talking Heads studio album, Naked.
Was a Pizza Hut. We sang up, keep it dry. She passed the time. Same blood as you and